Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird and its hero, Atticus Finch, have been so loved for so long that it's hard to imagine her writing any other way. But she did. Years ago, about the same small town of Macomb, Alabama, but it's the 1950s. Scout is a grown woman. Atticus is not the shining hero. Race and racism are much more complicated. This hour on Point, Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you reading this book already? Are you afraid to go there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The book out just yesterday in bookstores, though of course there's been a drumbeat about it's coming for months and months now. Lots of talk about how it emerged, seemingly out of nowhere. With us first today from New York is Alexandra Alter. She covers the publishing industry for the New York Times. Alexandra, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Where did this new old book come from?
So as you noted, when the publication was announced in February, it was a huge shock to the public and to fans of Harper Lee, but scholars and her friends and family have known about this book for decades. It was her first attempt at writing a novel. She wrote it in the mid-1950s when she was living in New York and occasionally traveling back to Alabama, and she submitted it to publishers. J.B. Lippincott bought the book, and her editor there, who was Tay Hohoff, thought it was very promising but needed some work. She was very taken with the flashbacks to Scout's childhood and urged Harper Lee to rework it. And the resulting book, which came out 2 years later or 3 years later, was To Kill a Mockingbird, which, of course, now, you know, for decades has stood as her single and only work. It's, you know, taught regularly in high schools. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It's become part of the country's identity. She's just a huge national figure. So it's been incredibly surprising and fascinating to see her legacy added to it at this very late stage in her life. She's now 89 years old.
Now, when you say the publishers back in the 1950s said, "Hey, Harper, go and rework this," I read Go Set a Watchman yesterday. I got it as soon as it came out. This does not seem to me like a reworking of To Kill a Mockingbird seems like a different book, as though they said, let's pick up on this thread and that thread and that thread and this style, because the style is very recognizable, and write a kind of prequel to what you've given us here. Write a different book.
I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, there were, she took the core of the story, the childhood. You know, they referenced the famous trial that when Atticus defends Tom Robinson, they reference that in Go Set a Watchman, but that becomes a central plot point in To Kill a Mockingbird. So, no, this is not merely a draft. There's only a few passages that overlap verbatim, and they're sort of descriptions of the town or descriptions of certain relatives. So yes, when I say reworking, I mean a different novel with the same characters, but, you know, a completely different story.
Alexandra,
sorry, go ahead.
Do we know what Harper Lee thought about it at the time? I mean, talk about it, a bold request from an editor. You've got a nice style, write a different book, and maybe we'll publish it. And, of course, the rest is history. Did Harper Lee, is there correspondence where she's smacking her forehead and saying, "Oh, you've got to be kidding me," or what do we know about that?
So what we know from her biographer, Charles Shields, is that she was, you know, kind of devastated by the responses. You know, debut author would be. She at one point was so frustrated, she apparently threw the pages of the book out the window in New York into the snow, and then finally went down and recovered them and started writing again. In her own statement, which was put out by her lawyer in February, she said that she described getting these instructions from her editor at the time and saying, "I was a first-time writer, so I did as I was told." She was sort of indicating that she was insecure and was willing to rely on the guidance of others. But I haven't seen much correspondence to the effect, except for a letter that I read that's at Columbia University's archives that Harper Lee wrote to her literary agent when the book was finally accepted as To Kill a Mockingbird, and she said she cried tears of joy. She was so relieved that they thought it was good enough to publish in that form.
Alexandra Alter covers publishing for the New York Times, telling us the story of how this book, Ghost at a Watchman, came to be before To Kill a Mockingbird. Of course, that an icon of American culture. Alexandra, thank you very much for giving us a couple minutes on the background right there today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just listen to a little bit from the very top of the newly released Ghost at a Watchman. This is actress Reese Witherspoon reading for the audio book, reading from the first two paragraphs of the new old novel.
Since Atlanta, she had looked out the dining car window with a delight almost physical. Over her breakfast coffee, she watched the last of Georgia's hills recede and the red earth appear. And with it, 10 roofed houses set in the middle of swept yards. And in the yards, the inevitable verbena grew, surrounded by whitewashed tires. She grinned when she saw her first TV antenna atop an unpainted Negro house. As they multiplied, her joy rose. Jean Louise Finch always made this journey by air, but she decided to go by train from New York to Macomb Junction on her fifth annual trip home. For one thing, she had the life scared out of her the last time she was on a plane. The pilot elected to fly through a tornado. For another thing, flying home meant her father rising at 3 a.m, driving 100 miles to meet her in Mobile, and doing a full day's work afterwards. He was 72 now, and this was no longer fair.
Reese Witherspoon reading from the audiobook of Ghost at a Watchman. Jean Louise Finch there, of course, Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird, and her father, referenced there, now 72 years old in the 1950s, of course, Atticus Finch of To Kill a Mockingbird fame. I want to welcome to our conversation right now from Washington, Katie Waldman. She covers language, literature, books for Slate. She's a huge To Kill a Mockingbird fan, just finished reading Ghost at a Watchman. Katie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I mean, there's so much attention being paid to this. First, just because to have another Harper Lee book in circulation is enormous. And then because the tone and setting are so different, and Atticus Finch, our great hero, is not nearly so heroic. In fact, you could say deeply the opposite here. And yet I found beginning to read Ghost at a Watchman, the pleasures of reading Harper Lee are very much the same as I recall from To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, when she takes you back to Macomb, Alabama, puts you with the kids in the streets at their games and their small-town life, you can be charmed before you're whacked around.
I absolutely agree. I think she is so good at creating atmosphere, and she has this gentle rhythm that kind of lulls you, and her evocations of place are really vivid. And I remember I read the first few chapters before I got to sort of the revelation moment where, you know, the scales fall from Scout's eyes, from Jean Louise's eyes, and she realizes what her father believes. And I was thinking, oh, I'm home. And it's exactly the same sort of homecoming that Jean Louise feels when she returns. And then suddenly that illusion, that safety is shattered.
How do you get your head around the difference between these books? Harper Lee went back apparently after having written this. And it's very, very telling. You get lots of insight into white Southern thinking, if not so much beyond that. And into bigotry and into racism, very much alive in the 1950s. What do you make of her then plunging back into the 30s, where those things also exist, but giving us this very much more hopeful story in To Kill a Mockingbird?
Yeah, well, I think one reaction I had reading this new old book is that its impulse, or like the governing impulse behind it, seemed much more contemporary to me than the one behind Mockingbird, in that we are all about sort of darkening and complicating our heroes. We've got The Dark Knight Rises. We've got all these sort of gritty takes on our icons. And this book felt much more of a piece with that desire to sort of cast our heroes in a less flattering light, whereas Mockingbird seems like it was really an author looking to show sort of the commonalities, the empathy that bind people together. And I do think it's striking that she chose, or her editor guided her, to highlight that much more optimistic, hopeful, humanist theme.
Does that mean that this cultural icon for so many decades, To Kill a Mockingbird, is or might be, in fact, a kind of sugared up version of the South? Have we been fed a kind of rosy, almost children's story by comparison to Go Set a Watchman that we've been enthralled with for all these years?
Oh, gosh, I hope not. I mean, I would like to believe that sort of the depiction of Southern bigotry and of prejudice is very powerful in To Kill a Mockingbird. It's
true.
Just that Scout's disillusionment sort of unfolds on the level of society and culture, as opposed to on this more intimate local level of seeing these things in her father, in this one man who she's trusted. So I think that the disillusionment is there. It's just, it's personal rather than broader and cultural.
We're going to dive into the most potent moral force in her life was the love of her father, Harper Lee writes in Go Set a Watchman, but things get extremely fraught there. This title comes from a phrase in Isaiah where the Old Testament prophet is envisioning the fall of Babylon. He says, go set out someone to watch while we, I guess, feast as things fall apart. Is that what's going on in the South of Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman Day, Katie?
That's a great reading. I sort of interpreted the Watchman as a figure for human conscience. I also thought it was pretty interesting that our first glimpse of Atticus is he's wearing two watches. So he is literally a watchman, a man of dual watches with a kind of moral doubleness as well.
Atticus Finch with a very much a moral doubleness in Harper Lee's new old Go Set a Watchman, out just as of yesterday. Little soundtrack from the old movie, To Kill a Mockingbird, behind us here. Katie Waldman, please stand by in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Harper Lee's new old book, Go Set a Watchman, the racially challenging, unsettling cousin to the much-loved To Kill a Mockingbird. The book just on sale as of yesterday, and of course that was a little easier earlier in the UK than it was in the US. Books flying off the shelves there. Here's a woman waiting at a Waterstones bookstore in Britain to buy Harper Lee's latest, Go Set a Watchman.
When you've waited 55 years for another novel to come out, how can you not be there from the very beginning to say, I did that and I got the first one?
What attached so many people to Kill a Mockingbird? Well, these wonderful descriptions of small-town life in the Old South, but also the nobility of the father of Scout, Atticus Finch, standing up against racism, advising his daughter here from the 1962 film adaptation to sort of walk a mile in another's shoes. Don't judge until you can climb inside the skin of another, even an African-American, black man or woman, and get a sense of what's going on there.
You just learn a single trick, Scout. You get along a lot better with all kinds of folks. You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
Sir?
Till you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
The Atticus Finch of Go Set a Watchman, not so very interested in that. It was just last Friday, PBS aired an updated version of its 2012 documentary. Harper Lee, Hey Boo, Oprah Winfrey, writer James McBride, Tom Brokaw, all reflecting here on Lee's best-selling American classic, To Kill a Mockingbird.
The kind of inner wisdom and compassion it took for her to understand what it was like to be in somebody else's skin. That's pretty remarkable for that time.
What other writer during that time was willing to take on this subject? What other white writer?
She was in that pantheon, I think, of people who helped us get liberated from racism in this country.
Maybe so, but she had already written about that racism in much more searing kind of intimacy in Ghosts at a Watchman before she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, that first book, now out. Katie Waldman is with us. She covers language, literature, books for Slate. Katie, please stand by in Washington. With us right now from Harper Lee's hometown of Monroeville, Alabama, is Wayne Flint, a friend of Harper Lee, retired professor of history at Auburn University. Research focuses on Alabama politics and culture and religion. Wayne Flint, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
What do you make of what we read between the covers of Ghosts at a Watchman compared to To Kill a Mockingbird, sir?
I think it's wonderful parable from a woman who's a biblicist who lives with the Bible more than people realize, and from that rich religious culture of the South. It's a story of a prodigal daughter or a prodigal father drawn from the prodigal son. I think it's really the same Atticus, but I think maybe part of the takeaway after we get through with the racial theme that Charleston brought once again to the fore, it's almost as if American history is reconstructing itself around the publication of her two books.
Mm-hmm.
So just as To Kill a Mockingbird was conditioned to be a book about race, so is now Ghosts at a Watchman. And I think you could make a case for the prodigalness of both the daughter and the father in this new book. But you could also make an argument that this is about the eternal prodigalness in everybody, and that what is going on here are the passages of our lives where from 6 to 9, and assuming we are not abused by our parents, we think they're perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And from 13 to 30, we think they're captured completely by their institutions and their cultures because they have to live within those, and we slip the bonds and move to New York or Seattle or Chicago mm-hmm. or someplace else. Mm-hmm. And small-town people are always living within the boundaries of those traditions and histories that are part of their family. And so what we have here is the attempt of a young woman to escape the bonds, which I guess all of us have gone through between 13 and 27 or 28, and then the reconstruction, the reconciliation, the redemption that comes biblically through the reengagement. So I don't really like the old Atticus of To Kill a Mockingbird nearly as much as I like the new Atticus, a man trapped within his culture and trying to make the best he can of it and confronting the self-righteousness and preachiness of his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me he's a more full-blown man, a more believable man, a man with all the inadequacies of all of our families and all of our histories and all of our institutions. I really love Watchmen, although I don't think the characterizations are quite as brilliant. But every now and then, there is a passage that just rises to the level of poetry.
I thought it was pretty terrific read, and given all the sort of forbidding descriptions of the racism and the fall of Atticus Finch, I was a little afraid to go in there. But Harper Lee has these wonderful depictions of that life, sometimes joyful and other times searing, but so affecting. She can give you a snappy little insight on human nature in every paragraph when she's in the mood to do that. And she can take you deep into the drama of the civil rights era. I mean, Katie Waldman in Washington, we have her father saying to her at one point in here, when they really get down to it, when she tells him he's worse than Hitler, he's talking about African Americans in their community rising up in the civil rights movement, demanding more, demanding integration. And here's Atticus Finch saying to his daughter, "Do you want them in our world?" These are hard words to read, Katie.
I agree, and I'm definitely sympathetic to the reading of this new old book as a more complicated and human, nuanced, warm depiction of all of us and our frailty. But I do wonder whether it's a little bit too apologetic when it comes to Atticus. These ideas that he's voicing are not just sort of the stale traditions that all of our parents have that we eventually throw off. These are really toxic ideas. And I think a part of me, while I rejoice to see that spirit of tolerance and empathy that was familiar from To Kill a Mockingbird applied to Atticus, I was a little bit queasy at how much we were supposed to forgive and let live.
It is pretty incredible, Wayne Flint. There are speeches, soliloquies in this book that you could pick up today and put in the mouths of those arguing over the Confederate flag in South Carolina.
Absolutely, Tom. But you know, if you put this in the larger world of literature, I just happen to have been reading Marianne Robinson's Home from the Brilliant Trilogy, Gilead and Home and Lila. This is a writer at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, won a Pulitzer Prize for Gilead. And I just couldn't help but be struck by the similarities between growing up in Gilead, Iowa. When the prodigal son comes home, he turns on the TV, and there's Montgomery, Alabama, 1956, and there's Arthurine Lucy being turned down. And so he has a confrontation with his Presbyterian father, who's a two-generation minister in Gilead, Iowa, a town about the size of Monroeville. And in that conversation, the father is saying, well, you can expect the police just to stand around while there's anarchy among the blacks, and they have to fight back. And Arthurine Lucy was turned down because she was black, and she was not ready. She had not been civilized. She had not been. And so the father, the son, are having the very same conversation in Home with the son representing Harper Lee or Jean Louise Finch, and the father representing the forces of tradition. So this is not just a Southern book. It's a book that Mary Lynn Robinson writes in Home. Mm-hmm. And if you read Home and read the parallels, it's amazing that this conversation can be about race in the South, but it can be about homosexuality, or it can be about xenophobia and nativism and immigrants. Donald Trump has a son. And if the son comes home after what he's been saying about Mexicans, do you reckon he could have the same conversation?
I don't know if there's quite the nuance of Atticus Finch there, but maybe. Dana Williams joins us in just a moment from Howard University, and I'm really looking forward to her observations here. She's chair of the English department there. But a couple calls first, if I may. Jennifer in Savannah, Georgia. Jennifer, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Hello, Tom. One of the comments I wanted to make is and point out that I have not read Bo Set a Watchman yet. I read To Kill a Mockingbird again about 8 months ago. And I was born and raised in Denver, Colorado, and moved to Savannah, Georgia about a little over 10 years ago. And I think what I realized after moving to the South and being here 10 years is that it was easier to read books like To Kill a Mockingbird and perhaps Go Set a Watchman living in a city that wasn't as complex racially as it is now living in the South. And though I don't agree or condone what people say in terms of racism, I have a deeper understanding of where both sides come from after living here. And I think that the book points out the conflicts that people have within themselves. And a character like Atticus Finch, on one end, you can look at him simplistically in To Kill a Mockingbird and being very, very empathetic. But then when you look at him on a deeper level in the new book, you can see that even within one person, there's very complex ideas that somebody has, and that those ideas or feelings come out when they feel threatened or when life around them is really, really changing, as what happened during the civil rights era and what's happening now with the flag issues and the Confederate in South Carolina, and even this is a discussion that's going on a lot in Georgia and in Savannah. At our Jewish congregation, we have people who were active during the Civil War, and we had an issue just coming up about honoring people who were in the Civil War, but we decided to put it off because you call them heroines or heroes, or, you know, is there a more a different description you need to have to discuss people who were involved?
Jennifer, you're a wonderful reader, and you get to the beauty of literature, which is the nuance it can bring to us. And there's plenty of nuance here, not all of it easy, but then who said literature was supposed to be easy? A point of history, Wayne Flint, if I may, you're there in Monroeville, Alabama. I mean, in this new book, you've got Atticus Finch in the Citizens' Council. Is that the same as the Ku Klux Klan?
No, it's sort of the button-down collar, fairly well-educated, wealthy power brokers. They considered the Klan white trash and partly the ones who were stimulating black reaction by their violence. So these are the people who eschewed violence, but wanted to basically preserve apartheid, but within a legal structure of apartheid. So they were what I would call a moral, ethical accommodationist to their culture. The way Nell depicts her father toward the end of the book is one who makes the compromises from her point of view, she hopes, in order to control the Klan, in order to keep the violence down. And Monroeville, historically, actually fits that pattern. That is, the accommodationists were able to say, don't worry about keeping blacks in their place. We'll take care of that, but through institutions short of violence.
You've got Atticus Finch saying in Go Set a Watchman, saying to a scout to his daughter, do you want Negroes by the carload in our schools and churches and theaters? Do you want them in our world? And on and on. She responds.
Yeah, that's the way you become authentic and validate yourself to a community so they think they can trust you and they don't have to turn to the Klan. But, you know, that's also maybe who he is.
Maybe so. Dana Williams joins us right now from Washington, chair of the Department of English, professor of African American literature at Howard University. Professor Williams, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. I'm happy to join you.
Have you had a chance to dip into Go Set a Watchman? And what do you read there, madam?
I have. I must say that it was an interesting read. I had pushed back initially against reading it, and especially reading it so quickly, because I wasn't sure about Harper Lee's willingness or her fitness in terms of being able to agree to have it published. But having so much conversation around it and reading it in the context of what's going on in the world, I found it very interesting. And I've made the comment a little bit earlier that to some degree, I think that the book is a gift in the sense that it forces us to have conversations that we don't normally want to have, particularly those that we've already begun to talk about on this show. And I have to agree with Katie that I think we are probably a little bit too apologetic, or the book is a little bit too apologetic for not only Atticus's turn, but actually Scout's turn as well. Mm. The book closes with her understanding her father's racism.
Essentially, it seems to do that. Does it make To Kill a Mockingbird look like some kind of sugar-coated version of what Harper Lee presented here, Dana?
Well, I think so, but I think we also have to think about it in the context of the publishing industry, really. I think we've had some commentary from Harper Lee about her editor making certain suggestions, and I think that all of us would agree that the flashbacks, even in Go Set a Watchman, are far more interesting to some degree than the narration that we see with the straightforward third person. And at certain points, there's this elision between the first person and between the narrator, who is third person. But if we think about it in the context of 1960, when To Kill a Mockingbird first comes out, there's no way the publishing industry publishes Go Set a Watchman. It's just impossible based on the reality of America's attempt to create its own national narrative that was anti-communist, that was grappling mightily with immigration acts, or the overwhelming amount of tension that was in the country. Go Set a Watchman can't come out then.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Harper Lee's new old book, Ghosts at a Watchman, the racially challenging, unsettling cousin to the much-loved To Kill a Mockingbird. The book just out in bookstores as of yesterday. Many people snatching it up, beginning to read it, or having read it overnight. With us to discuss it, a friend of Harper Lee from Monroeville, Alabama, her town, Wayne Flint is here, retired professor of history at Auburn University. From Howard University in Washington, Dana Williams, professor of African American literature, chair of the Department of English there. And from Slate, Katie Waldman joins us. She has read it, looked into the whole background of how it came to be published and read now in 2015. Harper Lee, of course, herself, rarely heard from in recent years or for a long time. Here's a little bit from her last full interview. It was given to Roy Newquist of New York radio station WQXR in 1964. Harper Lee spoke with him about her literary aspirations.
I would like to be the chronicler of something that I think is going down the drain very swiftly. And that is small town, middle class, southern life. There is something universal in it. There's something to lament when it goes and it's passing. In other words, all I want to be is a Jane Austen of South Alabama.
That's all, the Jane Austen of South Alabama. There may be something to lament in its passing, but in Go Set a Watchman, Scout comes home. She's living in New York, and she's making an annual summer visit home, and she is disillusioned by what she finds there. Here's a bit more from the audiobook, Reese Witherspoon voicing Go Set a Watchman.
What was this blight that had come down over the people she loved? Did she see it in stark relief because she had been away from it? Had it percolated gradually through the years until now? Had it always been under her nose for her to see if she had only looked? No, not the last. What turned ordinary men into screaming dirt at the top of their voices? What made her kind of people harden and say nigger when the word had never crossed their lips before?
Reese Witherspoon reading from Go Set a Watchman. Julia is calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Julia, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. First, I want to say I love the show, and I listen every day. I can't tell you how upsetting it is to hear NPR in general make statements about a book saying that it's racist or that one of the main characters is racist, and that's kind of turning people off. Some smart people that I know are not wanting to read this book because of what they hear on NPR, and that kind of goes against what I think of NPR and what I think of this book. I read this book yesterday, cover to cover, and I didn't get racist at all from Atticus. I listened to his words. I trust him. And what he says to Scout is they're not ready. He's not talking about black people. He's talking about uneducated, unready citizens. And he's saying that they're backward in that they're getting all these rights when really, as he calls himself, a Jeffersonian Democrat, he believes, as you know, many people did, that the right to vote is something that should be trusted to the people who can best use it.
But Julia, let me just ask in response. I mean, first of all, though I did find Harper Lee depicting racism in this book. I don't think we're depicting it as a racist book, though you can argue over whether it's too sympathetic to racism, certainly. It's certainly a revealing book, but I wonder, Julie, if maybe Atticus Finch's silver tongue has taken you a little bit here. I mean, I recognize what you're quoting there from him is, yes, that's his whole point in the book. These Negroes are not ready, but that was the very justification for segregation in the South that the civil rights movement was mounted to push against, was it not, Julia?
Oh, I agree, but I think in the book, it purposely portrays both sides. We hear the rantings of that man in the meeting that, you know, Scout overhears. But even Atticus says, I let him do it because he wanted to. And later she realizes that it's everybody's right to make a fool of themselves. And Atticus knows that. But I trust Atticus because not because he's so eloquent, but because his basis for everything that we know about him is rooted in the law, which is equal to everyone. And she keeps going back to that same phrase, you know, equal, everyone is equal. And I I don't see him as racist. I see him as the watchman. Both set of watchmen so they can tell us what they see. And that's what he's doing there in my mind. He's not at that meeting because he doesn't want Negroes in the school. He's at that meeting, along with Henry, to see what's going on so that some good can come of it later. I trust him, and I don't think anybody who's thinking of not reading the book just because they're afraid of tainting their opinion of Atticus Finch is missing out on some really deep and rich characterization of him, especially the father-daughter element.
Julie, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. I wouldn't want to discourage anyone from reading it. I think it's a worthwhile read in many dimensions. I can't say that I'm ready to roll with you in your depiction. I mean, it's hard to get away from the power of To Kill a Mockingbird's Atticus Finch. It's hard to get away from the image of the noble Gregory Peck. Dana Williams, Julia is ready to kind of accept the Atticus Finch rationale for segregation that Harper Lee conveys in Go Set a Watchman. What do you think of that, Dana?
It's unsettling, to say the least, but unfortunately not surprising. There is a passage on 250, a couple of sentences mm-hmm. I'll just take a look at in particular, where Scout is arguing at the top of her lungs with her father, and she says, "We've agreed that they're backward, that they're illiterate, that they're dirty and comical and shiftless and no good. They're infants and they're stupid, some of them, but haven't we agreed on one thing? And we haven't agreed on one thing, and we never will. You deny that they're human." So to suggest that he's not racist is blind, or a willingness to submit to a racist system that really accords whiteness with privilege and power. And that's part of the point that Hank tries to make. He's clear that as a Clinton and white trash, he doesn't have the same privilege that Scout has mm-hmm. as a Finch. And that the only way that he can buy into whiteness is to accept the conditions under which whiteness is granted to trash. So it really speaks to, and that's part of why I'm suggesting that the book is interesting in ways that I wasn't prepared to deal with. Mm-hmm. It forces us to really think about the social milieu out of which he comes, but it also forces us to think about white privilege and how incredibly difficult it is and how unwilling people are to really retreat from that privilege. As long as it's extended to you, you don't have a sense of what it does to people who are oppressed. It's not an evened portrayal at all.
This is Hank, or Henry Clinton, who would very much like to marry Scout, and her Finch relatives not so keen on that because he's not from the right side of the tracks, and they're very outspoken about that as well. Wayne Flint, can you shed some light here on Harper Lee's own father and the evolution of his racial attitudes during this period? Might they have informed Go Set a Watchman?
Definitely, Tom. And it's probably important to remember that she's just not an historian of race and family. She's a historian of class, race, and family. The really complex class structure that she depicts in To Kill a Mockingbird, the Cunninghams at sort of the top. These are the deserving poor in American history. And the Robert E. Lee Ewells, they're the undeserving poor. This is the trailer trash and the Ridge Runners and the Ku Klux Klansmen. And we feel very comfortable with her depictions of the complexity of white class. But in many ways, she's a really good social historian. And certainly, if you think of three people, her sister Alice, the brilliant lawyer who was trying to integrate Monroeville Methodist Church.
Harper Lee's actual sister, yes, Alice.
Yeah, this is the actual mm-hmm. sister. And she's trying to integrate the West Florida South Alabama Conference of the Methodist Church in the 1950s. Nell's off in New York, protected by living in a world that's quite friendly to her racial views. Her father, Coley Lee, Atticus Finch, is the one who's caught in a world where he feels he must stay. This is his world. He's 72 years old. He's a lawyer trying to cope with that world. His metamorphosis from segregationist by his mother's milk, by his culture, is slower than his two daughters. And it's kind of interesting if you take the three of them as the three parts of Southern culture, the one who cannot reconcile and leaves mm-hmm. and never comes back and wants to be in New York and doesn't want to be in Macon. And when she comes home, she fights all the time. just like I did with my father when I was 17 mm-hmm. in 1956 over race. Alice is the one who stays, does not leave, and fiercely tries to change Monroeville and Macomb. Atticus is the one who has to make a living here, and he's older, and he doesn't change as fast. If that's not the classic paradigm of change, where young people always want it faster, parents always resist it. And I might add, in the history of oral histories that I've done of African Americans in the Civil Rights Movement, it's the same kind of conflict. Dr. King launched the Children's March in Birmingham largely because the parents were employed, or they were school teachers, or they were working in funeral homes, and they were dependent upon the white power structure for jobs, and they couldn't afford to be put in jail for 6 months. They would lose their jobs. And many young blacks, 26 years old, confronted their fathers and mothers for their hypocrisy, saying, we need to change, but they're not willing to get out there in the streets. And so this is not a conversation just between white Southerners, young and old. Mm-hmm. It's a conversation between black Southerners, young and old. And Natasha Threadway, the former Poet Laureate in the United States, has told me that she had the same conversation as a young woman about her father, who was not bold enough in her view. So let's think that this is a generational passage, not just as a race thing. And I think a young woman from Plattsburgh, New York, got it exactly right.
I guess I read it as both, but certainly both. Katie Waldman with Slate. The book becomes really harrowing later on as Scout and her father, Atticus Finch, fight over his racial views or his views of how the civil rights era South ought to be structured. She just about losing her mind here, saying he's betrayed everything, comparing him to Hitler. And then the Uncle Jack intervention, sort of smacking upside the head Scout here. And do I hear you, Katie, saying you fully read her as preparing to rejoin this Southern culture as this book closes?
No, I think what we see with her is, and actually Uncle Jack puts this really beautifully. He says that she's learning to reduce Atticus to the status of human, and she had idolized him as an infallible god, and she had latched on her conscience like a barnacle to his. And this is in some ways a very traditional coming-of-age story about differentiating yourself from your parents. And there is a way in which I think Scout or Jean Louise is elevating her own views and saying, I stand by my convictions. I will have the independent courage of my convictions in that stubborn, bullheaded way that we love so much in Scout. But I do think that the overall message of the book is she wants to knit back the social fabric. She wants the family to reunite again. And while on one hand that's a very beautiful and harmonious impulse, it also kind of evoked to me the aftermath of World War II and the sort of lost cause romanticism where the emphasis is on reconciliation and not about sorting through like the really painful legacy of what had just happened. And so I guess I had very mixed feelings about the end.
Dana Williams, what do you take from this ultimately? Is this helpful for our American conversation in 2015? It is jarring to open the book, you know, to look at the date of publication. And of course, that's what it is because it sat around hidden for so long. Is this a useful conversation? It certainly can seem relevant, maybe too relevant. But is this a healthy exercise of our thinking about race at this point, Dana?
I think so, in part because we tend to want our heroes, whether they're fictional or historical, to do the shadow boxing of our demons for us so that we don't have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
This book suggests that you have to do it. We have to do it ourselves, and it can't be a fictional character if there's going to be any reconstruction of an American way of grappling with race. Then that's work that has to be done by real humans. And it also calls to mind, for me, the break to some degree with SNCC or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee after the Freedom Rides, where there's the break between the black faction and the white faction, where essentially some of the leadership is suggesting that white people have to work in their own communities to do that really hard work there.
Yep.
There is no need for this benevolence to black communities, that we have our communities under control.
Mm-hmm.
What will you do when it's time to go back to your community?
And go home and work on your own family.
Right. And this novel suggests to some degree that that work is harder than the work to work in another community, and that we're a little less willing.
Mm-hmm.
They were a little less willing to do the work in their own communities, in their own homes. So I think it's instructive in that regard.
Know thyself, work on thyself. Wayne Flint, we've got many callers who I don't have time to get to, asking whether Harper Lee really wants this book out and published. Is it clear that she is pleased with this?
Absolutely. My wife and I have spent time with her 3 consecutive days. She told one of her relatives 5 times in 2 days when he said, "Do you really want to publish this book?" And he really didn't think she should. And 5 times in 2 days she said, "Yes, yes, of course, yes, yes, stop asking me, yes." And she's really happy and she's thrilled. And I think To Kill a Mockingbird, she wants to lay it out there. And I think this conversation, and especially the callers, it's just been brilliant. Because what they're doing is enlarging this story and appropriating it farther on lives. And, weary or bitter, bewildered as we are, we wander out there. And I think it's part of God's grace to let us wander around so that we can know what it means to come home again. And that's what she did. And when she came home, she found she couldn't marry and she couldn't stay. And she had to go back to New York. Alice stayed. I stayed. And I fight to change Alabama rather than go to New York and give up on it. And that's a very human story.
Go Set a Watchman asks a lot of readers, gives a lot as well. No discouragement here from reading it, but be ready to think. Wayne Flint in Monroeville, Alabama. Katie Waldman with Slate in Washington. Dana Williams at Howard University in Washington. Our thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.